for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. AAA estimates that just over 38 million Americans will travel 50 miles or more this Thanksgiving holiday. The vast majority of those traveling will do so by automobile, and many of those drivers will be on the lookout for shortcuts and traffic-free routes. Here in the studio with me to discuss the current flow of traffic in the U.S., Robert Puentes with the Brookings Institution, joining us from the NPR studios in New York City, Tom Vanderbilt. He's author of the book Traffic, and I must confess to you that the Deputy Secretary of Transportation, John Porcari, is on his way here, but apparently caught in traffic. We are told he'll be here in about 3 minutes. And, of course, whether you're in traffic, if you are driving, please be safe. If you want to call into the program, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Tom Vanderbilt.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And good morning to you, Robert Puentes.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you both here. And if there are questions and comments, we'll look forward to hearing from you. Tom Vanderbilt, talk about some of the changing trends in the American traffic profile.
Yes, Diane. Well, I should just first point out that I took the subway to the interview this morning, which is why I, of course, am on time.
Makes sense.
In a plug for public transportation. But one thing I learned in researching the book that was interesting to me was if you look at from 1969 to 2001, the population grew by about 40% in the United States. But what really grew at a much greater rate during that time are the basically the per year, the number of miles that each American drives by car. It more than tripled the amount of the population growth. So when we talk about traffic congestion being an offshoot of there being too many people coming to the country or that we need to build more roads to accommodate growing population, that's one issue. But the real issue is that we really have become much more car dependent in the last few decades. And the commute to work, which is what most of us sort of think in terms of traffic, has become a smaller part of the overall driving picture. And what really has taken up a lot larger part of our activity is just discretionary driving, driving to things we used to essentially not drive to, like taking kids to school.
Hmm. And taking kids to school used to be a walking kind of thing, and now it's far more a driving thing. Robert Puentes, how have the driving patterns changed over the last decade?
The thing that we're seeing now is that, although Tom is exactly right, that the trajectory for year after year in this country was more and more driving, as we had these gigantic macro trends that were affecting this nation of women entering the workforce and metropolitan decentralization. These large trends just caused more and more driving year after year after year. But what's interesting is in the last few years, we've actually seen the largest sustained drops in driving that we've ever seen in this country.
How do you account for that?
Certainly a lot of this is due to the economic downturn. As unemployment creeps up to 10.5%, people are driving much less. And although we don't think that you need to drive more in order for the economy to grow, these things are clearly related to one another. So although we have seen it tick back up in recent weeks, recent months, the long-term trend is of this overall slowing down of overall driving, and then the economy is what's made it really fall off the table lately.
Do you think that that's likely to ease the kind of traffic congestion we're seeing on the roads these days?
Certainly they're all related. There's no doubt that traffic congestion is an ongoing headache for Americans all across the country. And folks who are listening to this now, driving up I-95 or whatever horrible road, are certainly experiencing their share of challenges when it comes to traffic congestion. But we need to keep, focused on the long-term challenges that are associated with traffic congestion. And we know that if we want this country to grow economically, if we want to grow environmentally in a sustainable way, if we're concerned about energy security, we have to get a handle on these long-term trends when it comes to traffic congestion, particularly around our nation's ports and in our nation's major metropolitan areas.
Robert Puentes, he's a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, on the line with us from our NPR station in New York City. Tom Vanderbilt, he writes about design, technology, science, and culture for Wired, Slate, The New York Times, and other publications. He's the author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do, and What It Says About Us. And joining us now here in the studio is Deputy Secretary of Transportation, John Porcari. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
You got caught in traffic.
I did. I took Metro to work, but I made the mistake of driving here.
And what did you find on the D.C. roads?
Well, not surprisingly, a lot of construction. And some of that is related to the stimulus projects that are underway, all badly needed construction. But we all have to live with the delays that come with that.
One of the things we've already heard this morning is that driving is going down, that the number of people who are driving is decreasing in part, as Robert Puentes has said, because of the economy. How do you see it?
Yes, we've seen it directly related to the economy. There were 16 straight months where driving has gone down. We also think that pivoting towards the future, having choices in transportation other than simply driving, and a balanced transportation system, providing those options is one of the most important things we can do.
When you say doing some other things, if there is not public transportation available, what do you do about that?
If there's not public transportation directly available, there's a lot we can do in terms of personal responsibility to reduce the driving. We can trip chain, combine trips. We can work with our neighbors and others to carpool. The options that we have in reducing the trips have been apparent in this recession. Those are the kinds of habits that make sense going forward.
So you see that subway, train, and bus ridership is apparently going up.
Yes, it is. And it's especially true where we have a more seamless transit system that connects people and jobs, where you have multiple ways to get there, where you have reduced headways, so it's more convenient. It's clear that people will ride transit when we provide those options.
Tom Vanderbilt, one of the elements involved here in terms of people sort of using their cars in different ways and parents taking their children to school instead of using the school bus, is perhaps because both parents are working, so they've got to manage that transportation to school in a different way.
Yes, exactly. This is something, if you look back to the 1950s, you had pretty much just the father working in many households, and this is sort of the classic Leave It to Beaver commute, and the father would leave. And now, of course, women have joined the workforce to essentially an equal amount as men, and now, the interesting thing is women are now driving to work in equal numbers as men, but they're sort of asked to shoulder a much larger part of that, all that other driving we were talking about, the discretionary driving. So there's an argument out there that women are perhaps causing more congestion or suffering more from it. They're the ones doing more driving at the peak hours on the roads that are tended to be most congested, doing things like ferrying children to school, doing errands and all that. As much as we talk about equality, there still seems to be a pronounced gender bias in that regard.
Robert.
And I think the interesting thing is that both these last comments are really related. So this is not just about traffic congestion because we have more folks driving. But as the Deputy Secretary said, a lot of this is about the way that we've built our communities over the last couple of decades. Very low density, very spread out, separating uses from one another. And as Tom said, making trips that were able to be combined with other trips, were able to be done by walking, possible. So we can't really do that anymore in many communities. That's a big problem in many places.
Aren't we sort of moving back to the old ways in terms of the way communities are now being constructed?
I think so. I think that it's really these dual trends that we're seeing. We are seeing some urban resurgence going on in metropolitan areas all across the country, but there's still very low-density development happening on the suburban fringe in many places, which in and of itself has its own impacts, but it has dramatic impacts on how we travel and on the infrastructure we need to support that.
I agree. It's what we're really trying to do in some ways is back to the future. We're trying to get back to the communities that our grandparents enjoyed, livable, walkable. And when we talk about livability as part of our transportation agenda, it's providing those kinds of options and so that you do not need to drive everywhere.
Secretary Porcari, how much stimulus money has actually gone to transportation projects thus far?
The total package is $48 billion. We have over 10,000 projects out there around the country. The obligation rate is over 70%. So what happens is the states and local governments build the projects. We reimburse them when the projects are completed. It's a little bit like buying a car. You don't pay the factory to build it. You pay for it when it's completed.
And what kind of projects are you talking about?
These are great projects. A lot of them are what we call system preservation, resurfacing, fixing potholes, replacing 40- or 50-year-old taxiways and runways, rebuilding transit systems, ordering new buses and rolling stock for transit. These are the kind of bread and butter replacement issues that we as a country have gotten behind on.
John Porcari, he's Deputy Secretary of Transportation, and Robert Puentes, he is with the Brookings Institution. On the line with us from New York City, Tom Vanderbilt, author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And just before the break, we were talking with Deputy Transportation Secretary John Porcari about stimulus money that's gone into the highway and city traffic program. Has any of that stimulus money gone to easing congestion?
Absolutely. There's projects throughout the country. Maybe the biggest example right now is Interstate 215 in Southern California, where it's both adding capacity and fixing safety issues. So there's a little bit of everything in the stimulus projects that we're doing. The common denominator is that these are lasting investments that pay off in terms of quality of life, livability, and future economic growth.
Give me an understanding of why you believe congestion has gotten so bad on our highways and roads?
Well, primarily because two things. The land use patterns in the country where, as Robert has pointed out, with the low density spread out land use patterns, it is the only way to get around. And second is as we have become a more prosperous and affluent society, we have the ability to do a lot of discretionary trips that we haven't necessarily done in the past. It shows in our daily driving habits.
But are we reaching that point where density is going to bring gridlock in cities like Washington, New York, Chicago. What are we doing to try to ease that kind of population usage of the roads?
Well, what we're doing first and foremost is making sure that we're building and maintaining a transportation system, not one single element, just roads, for example. Washington's a good example, but there's similar ones throughout the country. If we didn't have a metro system here in Washington, it would be absolutely unlivable, and we'd be unable to get around at all. Having those kind of options really helps. We also, by encouraging things like transit-oriented development, are able to make sure that people can walk as much as possible to the kinds of mixed-use 24-hour environment that many people want.
Tom Vanderbilt, how do you see it?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, congestion is somewhat a relative term. The average American gets to work in about 23 minutes each way, which would be the envy of much of the world in places like Sao Paulo, where people are sitting in traffic for hours. So and it's important to keep in mind that for the average American, driving by themselves to work is still the fastest way for them to get from point A to point B, and door-to-door transportation. So there's it's not to say that this is irrational behavior, people driving alone. Unfortunately, every additional person who does it makes things worse for everyone else on the road. And there's a great headline from the satirical newspaper The Onion, which said something like 89% of Americans favor mass transit for other people. And that's kind of the dilemma we have to deal with here, which is, I think gets to this issue of we have a lot of road capacity. It's been estimated 90% of American roads are not congested 90% of the time. Hmm. It's just a matter of using our existing capacity a little bit more smartly through things like congestion charging, real-time tolling, et cetera.
Congestion charging. Say more about that.
Well, this is an idea that has been adopted in other places around the world, ranging from London to Stockholm. And to use the example of flying at Thanksgiving, I mean, you wouldn't go to the airport today and expect to be able to buy a ticket that would be cheap. I mean, it's a very busy travel time, and you are paying more for that privilege of traveling during that time. The idea that you should be able to drive into New York City during morning rush hour for free and not pay anything extra because everyone else is on the road, it's sort of an idea that, you know, is used elsewhere in economics and markets, but somehow has not been applied to the roads. And it gives people an incentive not to drive, asking people to choose other ways to travel, to travel with other people to save money, or simply to drive at a different time. But we don't really ask people to make that decision. We sort of open the roads to everyone. And the result is, instead of asking them to pay with money, we force them to pay with their time, mm-hmm. and we have large queues.
So, Robert Fuentes, would you be in favor of seeing that kind of charging for high rate times?
Well, look, economists have long kind of complained about the fact that drivers don't pay for the roads that they use and the impacts that they have on those roads. So this is one place where we can certainly learn from our international competitors, because as Tom and folks have mentioned, they are really doing some serious experiments with these road kind of charges. They vary in their different forms. We have the cordon pricing charges outside of or in and around London. They're doing this in Singapore and a whole bunch of other places.
How do they do it? I mean, do they actually stop cars through tolls to toll booths?
In London, I believe it's done by license plate readers. So there are these high-tech cameras all across this cordon of the City of London that will read and identify license plates and assess charges that way. It's very technical. There's lots of different ways to do it. Mayor Bloomberg tried to do this in New York a few years ago. He had a plan to toll folks who drove into Manhattan below 80th Street, I believe is what it was. They couldn't get it through the legislature. But if they had gotten that through in New York, I think you really would have seen some real experimentation start here in this country.
Secretary Porcari, would you be in favor of that approach?
It's one of the tools in the toolkit, Diane. And in fact, you're seeing examples of it in Southern California, in Toronto. You'll see it locally in 18 months in the Intercounty Connector in Maryland, where it's a toll road. You will pay more based on time of day.
And of course, you served as Secretary of the Maryland Department of Transportation from 2007 to 2009. So you would like to see that kind of system put into place, not only in Maryland, but in other parts of the country?
Well, first, it's not a cure-all. For specific situations, sure, it can help. And I think it's much easier to have that discussion for new facilities than it is to go into New York City and try and do that retroactively.
How about these high occupancy toll lanes that I gather you're referring to, Tom, when you say if we could get people into cars with other people, we could save a lot of time and minimize traffic?
Yes, I think carpooling is sort of a lost art in America. It sort of reached its pinnacle in the 1970s, I think, with the Arab oil crisis, but has since declined in great measure, in part because of what we were talking about earlier, all this discretionary driving people are doing. It becomes harder to have a carpool when you're doing things like picking up your kids, doing all sorts of other errands. So, but from what I know, the facility in Orange County does quite well. It asks people to pay more during heavier traffic times, but there's also a free portion. If you're not forced to pay, you have a free option. You'll, of course, it'll take you longer, but it does give you that option. But the paid portion of that facility actually functions more efficiently. It handles more cars per hour at a higher speed, in part because of these strange dynamics of traffic.
Tom, in your book, Traffic, you've written about the role of roundabouts or circles, as we would call them. Tell me about that and how they affect the movement of traffic.
Well, we should specify these are modern roundabouts. I don't want to people to confuse things like DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. with that's sort of the old style traffic circle. This is essentially a modern sort of safety innovation, also good for traffic flow, that Americans seem to exhibit a certain resistance toward. They think that they actually are more dangerous than conventional intersections. They've been called circles of death, which is decidedly not true, and they also tend to handle traffic a bit more efficiently than four-way signalized intersections because you often don't have to come to a complete stop. Vehicles sort of can travel through without stopping. It all happens very organically. These aren't, again, a cure-all for every intersection in America. They wouldn't work in very large, high-volume intersections, but they're being adopted in countries around the world, from France to Australia, and are another way to sort of bring down the road toll, which we've been making great progress toward as well. But this is, again, safety is another thing that's related to congestion. It's been estimated that I think something like 30% of all what's called non-recurring congestion is related to incidents. A good portion of those are crashes. So if we can reduce the number of crashes, we reduce the amount of congestion.
I wonder whether any studies have been done on the rate of accidents at so-called roundabouts as opposed to four-way stop intersections, Mr. Secretary.
Yes, and in fact, the experience has been very positive. If they're properly designed, they're actually safer.
That's interesting.
And there is the issue of getting used to them. Once they are, they're safer. I would point out that the one drawback is for pedestrians, where for persons with disabilities, a roundabout is a very difficult endeavor, and it's difficult to make it consistent with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
And, people tend not to stop at those roundabouts. When they're moving and there is a crosswalk, they still tend not to stop.
Yes, and that's why the pedestrian part of it is a little more difficult, and it really puts an emphasis on designing it correctly.
What does designing it correctly mean, Robert?
Well, this is what it's all about. Certainly, there are some challenges with the roundabouts, but high volume, just regular old crossing intersections are also rather hostile for pedestrians. And there has been major emphasis for this administration and the U.S. Department of Transportation, some other folks, on safety, on making sure that our roadways are safe for not just for drivers, but for pedestrians as well. The way that we have designed these roads in the past have been for moving vehicles very quickly from point A to point B with very little consideration of what happens in between. Mm. That absolutely has to stop, and I think that we're seeing some very positive movement in that direction.
Now, there are a lot of other things for drivers to worry about, major potholes, for example. So, Tom, what's more important, keeping your eyes on the road or keeping your mind on the road?
Well, the two are decidedly not the same thing, and there's been a lot of interesting work in cognitive psychology dealing with things like inattention blindness, and there's a famous video you can see on the internet about this, where you can essentially be looking straight at something, and if you have sort of a search pattern in your head of what you're looking for, if something else comes along that you're not expecting, it can literally be right in front of your eyes, and you will not process that information. So the human attention span is very sort of fragile construct. We do not see everything that is out there in the world. We perceive certain things. And this is why I'm so disturbed by the sort of rise of multitasking, because driving by itself is a complex cognitive psychological activity, and to then add on a whole other layer of communication and distraction is just a very dangerous thing.
And I gather the Department of Transportation has really begun a program to educate people about the dangers of trying to multitask.
Yeah, this is a big focus for us. Diane, Secretary LaHood convened a national summit on distracted driving. We have embarked on a broad range effort to deal with that. We also have President Obama has signed an executive order so that federal employees lead by example that prohibits texting while driving in government vehicles or using government equipment.
What about telephoning?
There's varying levels of distraction, and what we're trying to do is make sure we understand what the data tells us on distraction. And one of the interesting sidelights to this is we think about this across the board in transportation, the distraction issues that apply in an airplane cockpit for the Federal Aviation Administration. Some of that same data and research is equally valid for drivers, and Secretary LaHood convened a safety council that cuts across all the transportation modes at the national level to make sure that on common issues like distraction, we're focusing, sharing research and focusing our efforts in sharing the results.
John Porcari is Deputy Secretary of Transportation, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You still haven't answered that question directly about telephoning while driving. What's your understanding, John, Robert Fuentes?
Look, I think it can't be good. I don't think there's any doubt that given the conditions, particularly driving in urban places, there are many hazards. Again, there are pedestrians. There's increasing volumes. We know that about 60% of traffic is caused from these non-recurring things like work zones, like incidents, like bad weather. You know, we have to make sure that we are starting to think about how people travel, particularly in cars, and the whole experience, not just, again, not just getting from point A to point B, but everything in between.
Tom Vanderbilt, is there a difference between an individual who has a telephone hands-free in the car and one who is holding a telephone with his or her left hand and driving with the right?
The scientists seem to say no, that it's really the conversation itself that is the problem. Dialing a telephone, while a distracting endeavor, is a very discreet, takes a few seconds, and then if you go on to have a half-hour phone conversation, that is really the source of the cognitive trouble there. And from that point of view, each of those are identical, and the crash rates also don't seem to differ very much. So we're at this interesting juncture right now where we have a patchwork of laws state by state across the country, some allowing hands-free, some not. Even in places like Texas, you get very strange distinctions about not being allowed to use a cell phone while driving through a school zone, which sends one message that you need to be safe in this area, but it's okay in the next block to sort of jump back on your phone, even if there might be kids walking from that school. So we're at sort of an interesting, I would say, historical juncture, similar perhaps to the way we once were a bit unsure about how to treat alcohol-impaired driving, and of course the record has become clear on that. It's still a problem, but we at least know where we stand.
Mr. Porcari, would you like to see a federal law banning the use of telephones in cars?
We need to make sure we understand the research first, Diane, and that's what we're doing right now. Everything that we do related to safety is and has to be backed by hard facts. And I think it's clear that we don't, partly because of that patchwork of what's out there and because of emerging technologies, we don't have the data to back up that part of the decision-making process. The president's executive order to federal employees is, we think, a very good first step, and again, leading by example. We'll see where the data takes us from here.
Tell me what's going on with the transportation bill.
Well, we are operating under a continuing resolution, which is not ideal. The surface transportation funding has generally been part of 6-year bills. We have been supporting an 18-month extension for the very purpose of moving forward nationally with transportation projects. It's very hard for the states and transit agencies around the country to move forward with large multi-year projects in this kind of uncertainty. We know that federal transportation investment is a very good investment in the economic future of the country, but the uncertainty by moving through continuing resolutions, and there were 6 short-term extensions between the last two surface – I'm sorry, there are 12 short-term extensions between the last two bills, is no way to go.
And there are calls for a tax increase on gasoline from some portions. The National Surface Transportation Infrastructure Financing Commission issued a report calling on Congress to enact a 10-cent per gallon increase in gas tax, 15 cent per gallon on diesel. Do you favor that?
Well, to be fair to the commission, those findings came out before we entered into this recession, and it is very difficult in these economic times to really do that.
John Porcari, Deputy Secretary of Transportation. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I'm sure we'll hear lots of interesting stories.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The November Reader's Review, Suzanne Burney's The Ghost at the Table. The story of a family whose secrets begin to unravel around the Thanksgiving dinner table. Manners, misperceptions, and holiday dysfunction. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We are talking about driving, congestion, what's happening all over the country, and efforts to bring some remedies to the situation. Here in the studio, John Porcari. He's Deputy Secretary of Transportation. Robert Puentes is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Joining us from the NPR studios in New York City, Tom Vanderbilt. He's author of the book titled Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Here's an email from Danny, who's in Dallas, Texas. He says, I drive a UPS truck for a living. I can't help but notice the average driver's lack of driving skills, much less courtesy or attention paid to the road while driving. From my personal daily observations, I can't help but think much of our road congestion is caused by such. Do you want to take that, Tom? What about training for driving these days?
Well, I actually, as someone who's taken the UK driving test and actually failed, I can certainly appreciate the idea that it is difficult in other countries, more difficult to acquire a license than it is in the United States.
Of course, there you have to drive on the left side of the road. I'd fail that one, too.
That is true. But this is, you know, other countries, people spend a lot more time, a lot more money having to get a license, and this definitely influences the driving population. There's an ongoing question here. Does driving education actually, what's the link between that and traffic safety? And there's not, unfortunately, not sort of really a clear link between the two. We used to think that giving kids driving lessons in high school was a good idea until a large study came out showing that actually basically didn't help anything at all. It just put more kids out on the road at a younger age, and they are a great risk. So we changed to something called graduated driver's licensing, which restricted their access on the road till age 18. And that's been sort of the only measurable safety impact, much more so than driver education. So it's a nice idea. I'm just not quite sure what its real effects would be or how to implement it.
What do you think, Mr. Secretary?
Oh, well, Tom's right. First of all, graduated licensing systems for young drivers around the country have been a big safety advance. And there's different ways of doing it, and states have implemented different levels of graduated licensing systems. But the evidence shows that it actually helps safety. It's harder when you get to the driver's education part of it because the data just doesn't support that it statistically helps.
Interesting. I had driver's education when I was in high school. I think I'm the best driver in the whole wide world. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question about the comparison of the public commute time using a bus versus a car. Here we have about what takes a half an hour in traffic to a 2 or 2.5 hour bus ride because of the lack of buses and the frequency of standing waiting for a change to another bus. Are there statistics on the nation about, I know there's commute statistics, but is it broken out to compare commute times with public transportation to a car? Because it's intolerable here, and what would do the best here is, instead of giving money to expand, is just to fill in what's lacking.
Thanks for calling, David. Robert Puentes.
We do have a lot of data on the commute because of the data that's collected with the U.S. Census. The commute trips make up only about, I think, about a fifth of all trips, so it is kind of just a small slice. But when we do think about traffic congestion, we are thinking a lot about the commute trip. But I think the caller is right that because of the way we've built our metropolitan areas and because of some of the lack of connectivity around, particularly around the bus network, we do see that those trips do wind up taking some of the longest time. So commuting in and around New York City, for example, does take a long time. But the quality of that trip is not really discussed in that data. So, look, if you're sitting on a subway and you're reading the newspaper, that might be a more pleasurable trip, even if it takes longer than if you're stuck in kind of bumper-to-bumper traffic, white-knuckling it down the freeway. So the international examples, I think, are very illustrative here. The looking at North American trips, they're actually quite short because we do have so many folks who are in the car as opposed to commuting on transit.
Secretary.
Robert's right. The quality of the commute is what matters. I can tell you from my personal life, switching from driving every day to commuting via transit, it's quality time. You can read the newspaper. Distraction doesn't apply. You can also text.
All right. To Roanoke, Virginia. Good morning, Rick. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. You have a great show and wonderful guest.
Thank
today.
You.
My question is, I travel a lot in Virginia and Carolina, and I'm seeing way too much, or I think it's way too much, paving projects and not as much heavy infrastructure. I call on pavers and contractors every day, and they're saying they're not seeing the money on the heavy stuff, the bridges, culverts, viaducts, those things.
One of the things that you're seeing in the stimulus projects that are out there is this kind of high-low mix. The first projects out the door were the easy, quick ones like repaving. Many states have large rebuilding projects, bridge reconstruction, for example, coming online is part of the Recovery Act. What we wanted to make sure we did was get the jobs out there, save and create jobs as quickly as possible. That was generally done by a mix of projects, especially on the highway side, where you started with the easy repaving ones and work your way up. There are a number of reconstruction projects that are in the $100 million plus range that are actually coming out there right now. And with the spring construction season, you'll see those orange barrels all over America.
Are you talking about the bridges, for example? Having seen that collapse in Minneapolis, I think a great many people are concerned about their own local bridges.
There's no doubt that as a country, we have fallen behind in maintaining our infrastructure, and we're, to some extent, living off the investments that our grandparents and our parents made. We all feel a sense of urgency that we need to leave this infrastructure better than we found it. That is not true today. That's why it's so important for us at Transportation to talk about a total system and to have the philosophy of fix it first. We should first start with fixing what we have and making sure it will last before we add new capacity.
But does that mean you've got a systematic program of going through the nation's bridge system and finding out what needs repairing?
Yes, we do have that, Diane. And the states are required to do that every 2 years. Many states have a more aggressive cycle than that. It's overseen and audited by the U.S. Department of Transportation. We are very focused on that. And I'd like to tell you that there are no issues out there in our bridges and tunnels. But we know better, and we know that that needs to be where the first dollars are put. That is part of the conversation that we're having with states right now.
Are you concerned about that, Robert Puentes?
Sure, there's no doubt, and I agree with everything that Deputy Secretary just said. I think that as it relates to the conversation around traffic congestion, if we are looking to ameliorate some of those problems around those headaches we talked about, again, only about 40% of overall traffic is caused by bottlenecks or deficiencies on the roadway network, regular traffic demands. And so much of this is due to traffic incidents or work zones or bad weather, special events, things like this, things that can be addressed through patrols, things through advanced telecommunications on the transportation network. There are so many things that we can do instead of these big investments just to relieve congestion. Now, there are absolutely some very good reasons to make these big investments, but we have to stop thinking that we're going to be able to build our way out of congestion, which is something that we've been struggling with over the last couple
what
of years.
What are the administration's plans for light rail, Mr. Porcari?
Well, thanks for asking, because we have some very aggressive plans for transit. Again, as part of a balanced transportation system, whether it's light rail, streetcars, buses, we're encouraging cities, towns, and rural areas throughout the country with paratransit to provide the kind of transit service that will give real alternatives to people, the kind of seamless transit alternatives that allow that. We are working very hard at streamlining the process internally of approving new projects. We're looking at the data for projects that have been completed to show the cost effectiveness of that. We're very bullish on this, knowing that where transit is done right, it works and people use it.
I grew up here in Washington when it was a city of streetcars. Tom Vanderbilt, how do streetcars, or do they, make a difference in not only a city like Washington, but in other areas around the country?
Well, I'm not really an expert on that, but I would just echo the idea that alternatives and just choices are incredibly important. We've gotten to a point in America where I think people often have no alternative, but there's an old cliche in transportation that you use a quart of gas to go get a quart of milk. And this is to take another example from Europe, the Dutch, for example. We look at a picture of Amsterdam. Everyone seems to be on a cycle. We think, oh, that must be just the Dutch love to cycle. But the Dutch actually love cars as well. They have one of the highest auto ownership rates in Europe. But to them, the car is a tool to be used in the right time and the right moment. It's not the only method they have to get around. They also have a wonderful bike system and many other ways to get around. So it's just, again, a matter of offering choices.
All right. To Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I am so interested in talking about this alternative transportation. In Ann Arbor, we have a very active bike commuter coalition, and it's actually Washtenaw Biking and Walking Coalition, so we're also interested in the safety of pedestrians. It's very active because we have people that bike year-round, commuting to work, and the most, there are a variety of things that you talked about today which are important to us. Fixing the potholes, if you think it's bad on a car, you should try it on a bike. Safety for both bicyclists and pedestrians, and that gets back to the distracted driving. So I guess my question is, what type of support can we get from the federal level? Because we have it locally. What kind of support can we get for alternative transportation?
John Pucari.
Great question, Karen. First, you need to know that there are senior members of Secretary LaHood's team that bike to work every day. This is truly not your father's DOT. And biking and walking is an important part of the agenda. The right-of-way, the roads, don't belong to just cars. They belong to pedestrians. They belong to bikers. What Robert talked about earlier, that balance between pedestrians safely being able to navigate across streets, bikes being able to use it, is really important. And it's something that we're working directly with the states on. It's something that we're encouraging both through formal programs and informally as we look at specific projects.
But do you have enough communities around the country who are willing to designate bike lanes so that these bikers can be and feel safe?
We do, and we're finding more and more interest in that around the country. And I want to point out, this isn't just a big city phenomenon. This is rural areas. This is small townships. It's clear that people are seeing the link between quality of life and bicycle and pedestrian activity. It's also tied in with the health activities of the administration.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a caller in Hanover, Maryland. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Diane. Welcome back, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Good morning, Secretary Pucari, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Wayne Dixon, president of the Harmon Civic Association. I agree with what the other distinguished members of the panel. I agree with what's been said this morning as to transportation matters, but how about this? We have a whole lot of beltways. And you keep adding lanes, and like we have the intercounty connectors and other road systems like that around the country. That's the right-of-way that we're using to build lanes for cars. How about using that same right-of-way, rather than adding lanes, making it for rail transportation?
Well, Wayne, wherever it makes sense, that right-of-way should be used for multimodal transportation, for more than just highways. There's examples with locally the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, for example, where you have a great bicycle pedestrian facility that actually connects Virginia and Maryland that simply wasn't there before. When you consciously think about these things, and it also, by the way, has provisions for light or heavy rail in the future. When you think about this as part of the design from the beginning, you can do that. It means making sure that there's comprehensive plans for transit. Whether or not it's the same right-of-way as highways or not is less important than you have a comprehensive system.
Here are two sort of opposing emails. First from Leslie, who says, in Stockholm, they've had a toll system for 2 years, license plates read by cameras. One gets the bill monthly. At peak times, the rate's $3 for leaving or entering the city. Otherwise, it's $1.50, no toll after 6:30 p.m. Then another email from Penelope, who says congestion charging is not fair. Then only the richer get to use the roads at the times everybody wants to. Robert.
It's an interesting point. I think that a lot of this it comes down to what we do with the revenue that we collect from these congestion pricing schemes. In London, they use that to massively expand and make efficiency improvements to the transit network. Mayor Bloomberg, I think, was planning to take some of the toll revenue from the plan they had in New York and to improve alternatives, not just transit, but bikes as well. So to ameliorate this problem, it really is about what we do with the revenue and how that impacts other folks overall.
Tom Vanderbilt, what's your reaction?
Well, I think there could be all sorts of tools applied, giving tax credits to low-income drivers who need to drive for work. And it's also been pointed out, for example, that other ways that we currently use to fund the roads, like sales tax, are also much more regressive for lower-income people. So we shouldn't necessarily think of congestion charging as the only way that affects people.
John Porcari.
And I think the day-to-day reality is if you are charged a dollar a minute to pick up your child, if you're late for daycare, that one day you will use it. And the rap on these lanes is that they're Lexus lanes. I don't think the evidence is actually there. I think that they're used by a mix of people, depending on the daily circumstances.
Well, as people drive on this holiday weekend, the real message, no matter how crowded the roads are, stay safe. Do not text as you drive, and try to keep your phone calls to a minimum. Thank you all so much for joining us. John Porcari, he's Deputy Secretary of Transportation. Robert Puentes, he's at the Brookings Institution. Tom Vanderbilt, his book is titled Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.